Blog Talk Radio.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is working to help keep you and your community safe from the threat of novel or new coronavirus. Take the following everyday steps to help avoid the spread of all respiratory viruses. Wash your hands often with soap and water for at least 20 seconds. Cover your cough or sneeze with a tissue. Throw the tissue away and then wash your hands. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects or surfaces, such as remote controls and doorknobs. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. And stay home if you are sick. Call your healthcare provider if you develop fever, cough, or difficulty breathing. For more tips, visit cdc.gov.
Good morning, and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keyes. I'm your host, Joy Keyes. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter, at Joy Keyes. You can also check us out on Facebook. That's Saturday Mornings with Joy Keyes. And we're on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keyes. Try to make it easy for you. You can also reach out to email me. I'm at SaturdaysWithJoyKeyes@hotmail.com. I'd love to hear any comments you have, suggestions, shows you like, people maybe you want to have back on, whatever it is, feel free to email me. I have a wonderful guest this morning, a labor of love, I would say it was. Kent Garrett and his partner, Jean Ellsworth, wrote a book called The Last Negroes at Harvard. Wonderful book, really interesting because, you know, you don't think about who were the first Negroes at Harvard, you know? So he lays it out. He wasn't the first, but there was a large group that started. So we're going to talk to him now. He's on the line. Good morning, Kent.
Hi, good morning. How are you? Thank you for having me on.
Thank you so much for writing the book, because I think, you know, history is important for us to know, and so we don't repeat it, one, but
right,
also just
right,
to enlighten us, like, oh, okay, that's what happened. You know what I mean?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So now tell the audience a little bit about where are you from, Kent?
Well, I'm originally from New York. I mean, I grew up in Brooklyn, in New York City, Brooklyn, in the Fort Greene Projects, and I now live in upstate New York. But I'm originally a New Yorker, and my parents and folks were all from people from South Carolina. I would go during the summers when I was growing up in New York City.
So now, where did this idea of going to Harvard come from? Did you know anything about this? Did your parents tell you? What happened with that?
Not really. I mean, my parents were pretty much, my dad was a subway motorman down in New York City. He drove the train and he had a floor waxing business. And I just did pretty well in school. I went to Boys High, which was a school, pretty good school in Brooklyn. And they had good counselors and advisors, and I was just advised to go to Harvard to apply, and I got in. And actually, during that year, another guy from Boys High got in, one of my classmates, at the same time. So it wasn't that I, you know, was particularly knew very much about Harvard or was that really interested in it, but I knew it was a good school. My parents knew it was a good school. And so I ended up going there.
So a cool story is how you drove up there with, like, the whole family. You were talking about that. I was, like, thinking, oh, my God, as a teenager, like, everybody's here. Okay,
right,
don't talk
exactly
to me too much. What were you feeling when you got there and got out the car and everything?
Well, I mean, I was really, you know, I was really nervous. I mean, again, I'm about, what am I, about 17, 16 years old, man. And it was like just landing kind of in, I'd not really been out of New York City very much. As I say, I'd gone to South Carolina, but I mean, it was like kind of landing on the moon. I mean, a whole different culture. I'd never seen buildings as majestic as that. And I grew up not really being around whites at all. In other words, I can't remember any whites ever coming to our house in Brooklyn. I knew white teachers in school, and There was some in the Boy Scouts, but I mean, to be in that environment was pretty nerve-wracking, and I was very nervous on that first day, as I remember.
So now your father, you talked about the floor waxing business, and I know you talked in there about the behavior that your father had while he was in these people's, in white people's homes. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it has to do with, you know, blacks kind of having to live and exist in sort of two worlds. And there is a, actually there's a funny contemporary comedian, a guy named Dion Coles, who talks about, he has a little skit where he talks about how blacks, again, Negroes at that time, have to kind of manage their blackness. And that was in order not to frighten whites, in order not to, you know, in order to get over it, in order to make it in the white world. And basically that's what he was doing. I mean, I didn't really find that out until, you know, I talked to him 50 years later, my dad 50 years later. And in the sense that when we would go to these floor waxing jobs, it was in a white communities in Long Island, and we would go in and I'd help him, you know, wax their kitchens and all that. And he would go into this sort of jolly, you know, kind of jolly Negro kind of performance mode. I mean, very cheerful and that sort of thing. And I always, it always made me uncomfortable. And as I say, 50 years later, I finally talked to him about that. And he said that, he told me that it was a question of how you needed to behave because you were, you know, going into white people's houses without, you know, without the men there and that sort of thing. So it kind of makes sense. But, I mean, it's the dilemma that I think blacks, you know, face today, even at Harvard. I mean, there were 18 of us, and, you know, we were the largest number of blacks at that time ever admitted, which was 1959. And, again, we were really curiosities, and we had to, you know, you sort of had to manage your blackness at that time, or your Negroness that time as well. I mean, and for us, the way Harvard set up, all of the freshmen lived together, you know, in around the yard, which is about 8 or 9 different sort of dormitories. But everybody eats together in the freshman union dining hall. And so we were able to, you know, set up there a kind of black table, the first black table.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
Yeah, we would all sit together because it was more comfortable. I mean, it was, you know, you could let your, I don't want to say guard, but you could let your, you know, you wouldn't have to worry about your Negroness or blackness at that table.
Well, you know what we call it is like code switching, you know.
Code switching.
Or Du Bois with the double consciousness. You're like, okay, I have to be this way here, and then I have to be another way here. And, you know, and one of the cool things you talked about in the book, which still happens today, where you said the head nod. Like you see another black person, may not know them very well, but you just know that, okay, that's the other black person, and you do the little head nod. And it made me think about when I was in Italy one time, and I saw this writer, I mean, in the middle of Italy, across the ocean, I'm walking down the street with my girlfriend, and we're eating a sandwich, and then I see it, and I'm like, oh, black people. And we kind of look, and I'm like, oh, I know that black person. You know, so it still happens.
Right.
The head nod still happens, no matter, you know, where you're around the globe.
I was in
Madrid in a restaurant, and this lady was like, hi, are you from America? And I was like, yes. And she was like, would you like to have dinner with us? I don't know this woman, but she was black. She had her son, and it was like, okay, you're cool because you're black, and, you know, hey, come on, sit down.
Exactly.
That's really cool.
And, you know, I mean, the thing is, like we were 18, but the whole class was about 1,100 guys, and so we're talking, we're like 1.595%, you know, I mean, it's really crazy.
So now, you were there for 4 years in Harvard?
Yeah, for 4 years.
And what was your most difficult course? I mean, I kind of know because it's based on the book, but I want you to tell the audience.
Well, you know, I went there with not really knowing what I wanted to do in terms of what kind of, you know, kind of what I wanted to do as a career or job-wise. And I didn't really have much to think about in terms of, I didn't know what was really on the horizon. And my mother and parents were, you know, we knew that successful people were either doctors or lawyers or that sort of thing. And, you know, I didn't really know about artists and filmmakers and that sort of thing. So I ended up being pre-med and was going to go to medical school, but I was really very bad at chemistry, and it just kicked my butt. And had a lot of trouble with that, but I ended up going to NYU Medical School after Harvard for a year, which I hated, which was really, you know, the wrong thing for me to do. But I mean, I when I got to my senior year, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, so I did apply and I got into NYU. But I mean, again, it was part of my sort of mother's, you know, my son the doctor syndrome, which
the dream,
you know, she was kind of the dream, right? Exactly. But so
you guys, go ahead. No, I was going to say that. So you guys, actually, when you were starting the book, you didn't actually get all the quote-unquote black people, and I wanted to, can you tell the story about that and trying to find people to interview?
Yeah, what happened is that I didn't, you know, so we're talking 50-some years later after college, and I'd been in touch with maybe two or three guys, and one guy, one of my classmates, didn't live not very far from me, and I'd been in touch with him, but I resorted to going to the register. There's a freshman register book that they put out, kind of a yearbook with little photos of black and white photos of all the people in your class. So I went to the book, and you know, I'd had three or four that I knew, and then I would look at the pictures and figure out this guy looked black, and maybe I remembered him, and that sort of thing. So I came up with a list of 17, and so I thought that was it. Okay. And again, the project started out as a video project. We got a grant to do a kind of a trailer that would lead to a larger documentary. I mean, my background is basically in TV news, that sort of thing. So we thought we had 17, and then they put out a little newsletter about every two or three months for our class, the class of Harvard 1963. And in that, we put in a little flyer saying, hey, we're doing this project, and if you have any information or if you have any insights about black members, Negro members of our class, get in touch with us. And some guy got in touch with us saying that, hey, there's more than 17. You're missing a couple of guys. And I said, holy smokes. I mean, I didn't miss at all. You know, when I was 17. And so he gave me the name of a guy, so I didn't know what to do next. You know, so I said, okay, being the intrepid sort of reporter that I was, I said, I just got to call these people up. So he gave me the name of a couple of guys. And I, so I resorted to calling, and this is like a very difficult phone call. I mean, you call up and, hi, my name is Kent Garrett. I was in the class with you, and a little small talk. And at the end, you ask, well, by the way, are you black or not? And I remember we called a doctor in San Francisco, and the guy, you know, he said no, that he wasn't. And I said, thank you. I mean, and when I think about it now, I wondered, what if he had said maybe, what if he said, I'll get back to you, you know.
Right.
That would have been trouble. So I finally trouble at all, right. So I finally found a guy who was a guy named Jerry Secundi, who's in the book, who really you could not tell. I mean, you know, I don't know if you call it the black dar or whatever that instinctual thing is.
When you said that in the book, people, I was cracking up. I said black dar, like gay dar.
Yeah, right, exactly. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, you couldn't really tell. But he was black, and I called him up, and he said yes, and he told me his whole story, and you know, it was pretty interesting.
You know, colorism is
Jerry Secundi.
Jerry Secundi. Colorism is still an issue. As a matter of fact, I just had Justin Driver on recently talking about the schoolhouse gate, and which dealt with the Supreme Court and public education. And, you know, he talked about a case where there were these two black men, but who could actually almost pass for white, and they did. They ended up going to California and living their lives and passing as white because it was just so much drama, I guess, dealing with being black, quote unquote, you know. So that happens. Now, some other great stories are we're talking about the black dar, but you also had a gaydar problem. Talk about that.
Oh, yeah. Well, the thing is, though, I mean, I didn't really, you know, we interviewed a fair number of, you know, white guys in our class to sort of get some perspective, you know, get their thoughts about what they thought about the Negroes or blacks in the class. And, you know, I'd never really thought about the gay situation, but I mean, there had been a gay problem at Harvard, I guess, back in the 20s, 1920s or so, when they really purged some gay students and faculty when it was, you know, when they were discovered, and it was really pretty bad. So, but when, you know, we had a, when we were in Mexico talking to one of our classmates. We had a classmate, a white guy, who had been down in Mexico when we were in school, and he had done some research and that. So we happened to meet him a couple of years ago, and he was in the class, and we were having a conversation, Gene and I and this guy, in a Mexican restaurant, and he mentioned that one of the guys had, a guy named Bobby Gibbs, had, you know, been in love with some other guy. And I said, holy smokes, I didn't even really know that. And I'd already interviewed Bobby, and I knew he'd been, you know, you get that feeling when somebody's holding something back when they're not really, you know, so I had that feeling about him, but I didn't quite know what it was. So I didn't know how to handle it. So I ended up, you know, kind of calling him up and saying, you know, I think we're going to have to deal with the gay issue in the book, and how do you feel about that? And he said, I feel great about it because, you know, I am gay. That was, you know, he spent 4 years suppressing it or being, you know, not coming out. And none of us knew it. I mean, none of us knew that that was the case. And apparently there was a number of gay people at Harvard in the class, and the Boston-Cambridge community had a pretty thriving gay community, which, you know, I didn't know about.
Right. I mean, you're being black is one thing. You're dealing with a, you know, black-white issue, but then you got black-gay male issues.
Right.
Like,
right.
Whoa, like all the stress they were under
right.
being there, you know, it's a whole different
right.
story.
Right.
So
he
now
was from the South, from Atlanta,
Mm-hmm. And you can't imagine, right? And because you weren't even thinking about it, like some of the things that were interesting is like you also did, in terms of your black history, that's something you talk about in the book. You did not know about a lot of black history because it just wasn't taught in schools and it wasn't talked about.
It wasn't
in your home.
Taught in schools, right? Exactly, exactly.
So,
yeah.
So that's something that still happens today. I was, you know, I'm telling you, these things are still happening today. These kids don't know their history, don't know about certain figures, don't know why things may be in place, you know. And even today in Philadelphia, like a couple years back, they were fighting against trying to have an African-American studies course. Like there was a it was a crazy huge uproar in the city of Philadelphia. It was like, oh my God, what are you talking about? I don't want my kids learn nothing. Oh, is this they gonna do that? Then we gotta have Irish history, we gotta have, you know, Polish history, we gotta have this.
Right.
People went ballistic. And I was like, oh my God, this is like current day, you know.
Wow.
So
Yeah.
So now you met a very famous activist, Malcolm X.
Yeah.
Can you talk to us about that?
Yes. Well, what happened is that we, you know, we were in our junior and senior year. I mean, a lot of things were going on in the South. I mean, you know, a lot of, with kids our age and students there, they were getting arrested and, you know, put in jail and getting beat up for just, you know, for the part of the whole civil rights movement. And we really felt that we had to do something. I mean, we were in this kind of bubble at Harvard, in the sense that there was really no overt racism, no, you know, no you know, you weren't in any physical danger, but we felt that just we had to do something. And the fact that there were 18 of us, we were really kind of an entity. I mean, there were enough of us to have both a group identity as well as an individual racial identity. And before that, before us, Harvard would let in maybe 3 or 4, sometimes none, blacks or Negroes per year. And Negroes would come and just, you do your studies and then just graduate and, you know, get out of town. Whereas with us, we were a force and we could change things. So we decided, my roommate, Jack Butler, was a very militant guy from Pittsburgh, and he decided that we would try and do something. And we ended up inviting Malcolm X to come. He had come to a Harvard Law School forum debate, and which I didn't get to go to. But then we had another friend who was an instructor, sort of in our house, in our dorm, and he knew Malcolm, or knew a cousin of Malcolm, and was able to get him to come and come to our dormitory.
Yeah, wow.
For dinner, and I mean that was like mind blowing. I mean that was like talk about being woke. I mean that was. I mean, a real charismatic guy. I mean, really, you know, no one, you know, we had not heard a black person speaking that way about blacks, about Negroes, about whites. So it really woke us all up. And I mean, it was
up close and personal, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Right.
So now from that point, you talk about in the book, like you said, you didn't go to the first time Malcolm X came to the campus. And you also talk about how race wasn't really discussed in your household to a great degree. It was just like, let's get along, do what we have to do. But you were part of starting the first one of the first African-American student groups. I also read that in the 1920s they had something called the Nile Club. You want to talk about the Nile Club and then also talk about the one you helped create?
Yeah, well, the Nile Club was set up. It involved not only kids from Harvard, but also other schools in the area. You know, Northeastern and BU. You know, and it wasn't on campus as such. I mean, it was a group of people who they wanted to get together to talk about the issues of race and that sort of thing. But they weren't sanctioned by the university, and as I say, it involved all blacks, all Negroes in the surrounding area from different colleges. So what we wanted to do was to set up an organization, a black student organization that would be only open to African and Afro American members of the student body. And again, we didn't have, it was just a matter we wanted to organize, and we wanted to maybe invite speakers in and talk among ourselves. And, you know, there was no radical agenda at the time. I mean, so thought we would, you know, it was a simple thing we would do. I mean, and so when we applied to, and again, there are advantages of being recognized as a Harvard organization entity. In other words, there was a sort of a pot of money that these organizations could use to invite speakers to college, to the college, and you know, you could solicit members at registration, that sort of thing, and you could use Harvard building facilities, and dorms and classrooms, which the Nile Club, you know, did not do. So we applied, and they said no, that this was reverse discrimination. And it was just astounding that we were just astounded that they would refuse it. In the sense that Harvard has these things that are called final clubs. They're kind of eating clubs, and where the aristocratic students they kind of live and eat and you know, have
socialize
and all that. And they don't let in Negroes, Jews, whites that come from new money and that sort of thing. So, and they've been around for hundreds of years. And so we just really hit the ceiling and were upset about that.
Right.
And they told us that, well, you know, those clubs exist, but they don't put it in their charter that they're exclusive. You know, so
right,
we
right.
decided that we just didn't want to be hypocritical and you know, lie and reach to that, you know, stoop to that level. And so that was the big issue, and it wasn't resolved until after we had left. But, I mean, the organization still exists today, and we were very happy that we had sort of set that up, but surprised that they had objected.
No, it's interesting. Like I was talking to you before, things are still happening today. And a young lady that I know at her company, they were trying to set up like an award ceremony. It was an all-black mm-hmm. affair, and not black ties.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about, you know, African-American affair. And her company, even though they let them have meetings of the black employees, they were like, oh, I don't think we can do the only black people. And
really?
They were like,
wow.
But it's for African Americans, and like this year, this happened.
Oh,
it was
wow.
a big deal at the company,
yeah.
you know. And it was like, when she told me the story, I was like, what? So you can have
yeah.
your little meetings, but what is the purpose of me? You can't go plan anything. And then they're like
right.
concerned. And again, they were going to bring in a speaker, you know, all these
yeah,
things,
right,
you know, just
right.
the same type of thing. But this was at
yeah.
a company. So it's still happening. These things are still happening. Now, some sad things did happen, you know, while in the writing of the book, some of your friends died. But one of the crazy stories that kind of just stood out, like almost maybe jolt, was the story dealing with the Boston Strangler. Do you mind talking about that real quick?
Well, I mean, I don't mind. I mean, in the sense that I'd part of the issues being young guys at Harvard and at college is also, you know, dating and that sort of thing and finding, you know, women to go out with. And,
right.
I'd gone to summer school one year. Between my junior year and senior year, I stayed in Cambridge and went to summer school and met, Sophia and, we just dated a few times, and it just turned out that she, you know, was killed by the Boston Strangler, and I didn't find this out until, you know, the next year, I guess December or so. But
crazy.
You know, I mean,
I was like,
crazy.
Wow, what? Out of like the
yeah.
story, and then it came like this little one, so I was like, bing, like what?
Yeah.
Wow. So
yeah.
I'm going to be giving away some copies of your book, The Last Negroes at Harvard. I thank you, Gene, for writing the book. Thank you so much, you know, for coming on the
okay,
show today,
well, thank
taking
you.
The time. And
okay.
I just want to say good luck with the rest of maybe
thank
you'll
you.
Write another book.
All right. Thank you.
All right. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody, for listening today. I just got off the phone with Kent Garrett. He wrote The Last Negroes at Harvard, along with his partner, Gene Ellsworth. I'm going to be giving away copies of the book, so check me out on Twitter, at Joy Keys. Also, check out Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. And you can check us out on Instagram. That's Saturdays with Joy Keys. Again, giving away copies. Keep your eyes peeled for the contest. I might have a question about something that happened in the interview today. Never know. So just remember, I might have to listen to the interview again. Next week, we're going to have some wonderful guests, Christian Sands on the call, and also actress Makia Cox from the show The Rookie. So stay tuned, and I'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
To some, a baby's babbling doesn't mean much, but it does, especially if there's no babbling at all. Little to no babbling by 12 months or later is just one of the possible signs of autism in children. Learn more at AutismSpeaks.org, brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.